welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
We've got a sequel of sorts today. We had our guest on last year, April, I believe, of 2020, to discuss her book, First Degree Rage, the true story of the assassin and obsession and murder. And she has her second book out in the series, Raging On, the Rage True Crime series. We are back with Detective Paula May to discuss this case as it continues to evolve for her. Thank you so much for coming back with us, Detective May.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So for our listeners, again, this episode appeared last April of 2020. So you can find it in the archives. But to catch listeners up and for newer listeners that would like to jump in feet first, can you give us a synopsis of the first book? And I remember the chilling quote you had from that book. There was no brown in his eyes at all. They were just two black buttons. I looked in his eyes. All I saw was solid black against the whites. It wasn't natural. It was creepy, unnerving, demonic. This story was really chilling. I remember getting so many different emails from people listening to this tale and this true crime story unfold. So if you could set the stage for us again on where we started in the first book, and then we'll launch into where the story continues.
Sure. Well, I definitely remember looking into his eyes and he being Elsie Underwood, who happened to be a police officer in my home state of North Carolina, where I worked. And that case began on a very cold, wintry day off of the Blue Ridge Parkway, where we found a body of a nude man who was blanketed by snow. And he had been shot and killed, shot twice in the head. And so we spent our initial hours getting him identified, and we discovered that he had been living in the town of Salisbury, North Carolina, so the home of Elsie Underwood. And so as the case progressed and we were able to identify the body, we found several interesting things about the body. He had actually been arrested for assassinating the Prime Minister, Olof Palme, of Sweden in 1986, but was later released when he could not be selected out of a lineup. And he sued the Swedish government for false arrest, and he came to the United States seeking political asylum and wound up after meeting some friends in Salisbury. Well, he met a really sweet lady who was a high school English teacher, and her name was Kay. Well, Kay was the ex-fiancée of this police officer. And Kay had also suffered the murder of her mother in December of 93, just before we found this body in the woods in January of 94. And so First Degree Rage is the story of the almost four-year investigation. And I was the lead detective in the case. I was working then with the Watauga County Sheriff's Office. And the case lasted so long because we had very little in the way of physical evidence. We did develop Underwood as a suspect early on. And so First Degree Rage is the story of what happened to Kay as she found herself threatened and her property vandalized, her son's life threatened, and just stalked and terrorized during Underwood's reign of terror. So First Degree Rage ended with his trial after some pretty amazing things happened in the way of developing our physical evidence, or at least analyzing the physical evidence that was found. Like I said, there was very little of it. And so it was also happened to be the first case in North Carolina that mitochondrial DNA analysis was introduced. So it's got a lot of really intriguing forensic elements in the case as well. But First Degree Rage ended with his trial. And he was subsequently convicted. It was a capital trial, but the jury was 11-1 for the death penalty. And so because it was not unanimous, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder and also another 40 years in prison on top of that for first-degree kidnapping. And so that is where first-degree rage ended. But he was never charged with the murder of Catherine Miller, Kay's sweet little mother, whom he brutally murdered in her home. And so...
Well, let me ask you, reeling back to the comment about his eyes and just...
Yes.
Was this something that as you talked to him, his eyes appeared to get darker? Did he just seem to have this overwhelming presence of evil around him, or was this more of just in the moment, you know, this is always how he looks, but it just looked even more terrifying than usual?
He did always have very dark eyes, but once it was just one-on-one and the rage inside him was seeping out, his eyes did get darker so that the dark brown in his eyes evaporated into just blackness. And the evil that was present became very real in those moments. I know Kay described something very similar at times when he just seemed to lose control on the inside. And he would not agree to be questioned by anyone else in the case, but he did ask to talk to me. So it was, so he and I were alone for some time, in a jail cell. He had requested that I come. He wanted to talk, said he was willing to talk, but he only wanted to talk to me. Now, ultimately, he was only trying to manipulate me and play games. He did have 19 and a half years of law enforcement experience, so he knew how the system worked. But when his efforts to manipulate me failed in that environment, that's when the rage became apparent. And even though he struggled to maintain his demeanor externally, it was very obvious that something was really wrong with him, that there was an evil presence there. And even the whole atmosphere, even the temperature of the room seemed to change.
That's really terrifying that you're in the presence of something, someone so dark that it actually affects the surroundings. You know, doing a paranormal show for 15, 16 years here, to hear something like that, it almost sounds like a case of possession.
Well, he definitely was demonically influenced, if not possessed. In my 32 years of law enforcement, there have been just a very few people I have encountered like that. But he definitely was one of them. And I have a very strong spiritual background and very committed to my religious belief. And so I think if I had not been, the whole experience would have been even more terrifying than it was. I seem to have a sense of calmness and peace that came over me, allowed me to talk with him, but it was very obvious that he was not in control, at least not the person that he once was. I think if you remember in the book, there's quite a bit of history as he grew up and how he was physically and emotionally abused. And whatever person he was at a young age was not the person that I interacted with during that case.
When you see something like that, you encounter something that seems almost otherworldly. How does that affect and impact the way you investigate a case and deal with that person?
Well, I think that depends on the investigator. For me, it's a spiritual battle, first and foremost. Of course, we have various interview and interrogation techniques that we use as investigators. But just the typical tactics are not going to work when you're trying to communicate with someone like that. And it was readily apparent, even from the beginning, that he was not going to give me anything as far as he certainly was not going to confess. He was not going to give me anything that he thought that I would be able to use against him in any way. He was more seeking to know what the evidence was against him. And I guess he thought he could get all of that information from me at that point. But as far as interviewing him, like I said, the peace of God just came over me, and there's so much divine intervention in that case anyway. It's mind-boggling. Just when we would be about to give up, something would just, you know, fall into our laps. But dealing with L.C. Underwood was a whole different, the whole different set of rules seemed to apply from just, you know, your typical interrogation with someone who has gotten themselves into trouble. No tactics would work as far as when you're dealing with a man who doesn't have a conscience, and I believe he was a psychopath. He has no conscience. He has no moral compass. He has nothing to, no kind of frame of reference that you can attach or, you know, begin at in order to prick his conscience or to appeal to him in some way that he would want to become cooperative. There just was nothing there. And I realized very quickly that one conversation, an attempt to interrogate him, was just an effort in futility.
Is it a whole different set of circumstances when you're dealing with somebody in law enforcement? Or do you just have to treat every perpetrator like you would any other perpetrator?
Well, in the ways as far as treating people with dignity and respect, even no matter what they've done, that doesn't change no matter what their occupation is. But when you are dealing with someone in law enforcement, it's almost like dealing with someone who's been in prison, in and out of prison most of their lives. They know the system. They know the drill. They know what you're trying to do. They know the information that you want to obtain. They also know the consequences of every statement that they give or of their conduct. They know the practical and realistic consequences. If you're dealing with a first-time offender, they have an element of the fear of the unknown. You know, they don't know if they're going to go to prison, or they don't know how long they will go to prison. They don't know the financial consequences. So you can work with someone and explaining those things, and you have some options. But if you're dealing with a repeat offender, your options become more limited. And if you're dealing with someone that's experienced in law enforcement, they know what's more than likely going to happen. They know where you're coming from. And they also know, in general, to keep their mouths shut as far as, you know, statements right that would further incriminate them. I don't like to use trickery and that kind of thing when interrogating someone. And we don't make promises on behalf of sentencing and that kind of thing. But, you know, we are in a position that we can, you know, go to bat for someone that is cooperative and make sure that the prosecution and the judge and the courts know that this person has been cooperative. They've demonstrated remorse. They're interested in finding a way to make things right, as opposed to someone like L.C. Underwood that just absolutely could not put himself in anyone else's shoes, has no sympathy, no empathy, no remorse whatsoever.
A complete sociopath, huh?
Yes, in my opinion, he definitely was. Even when we were talking about the murder of Catherine Miller, and she was just a sweet little grandmotherly type, 77 years old when she was murdered in her home. She had a little pan of beans on the stove and had gotten the newspaper in and was reading the newspaper. And she had worked at least 40 hours a week in an accounting department of a refrigeration firm. And she had worked for over 40 years and had rarely, if ever, missed a day of work. I mean, she was active in her church and her community. She was good to her neighbors. She was not anyone's enemy. But Underwood perceived her as his enemy because she was advising her only daughter, Kay, against remaining in a relationship with him, because she was very wise, I'm sure, and astute, and realized that he was bad news, and he definitely was no good for her daughter or her grandson. And so Elsie Underwood was aware of that. He also was aware of how emotionally dependent that Kay was on her mother, how close they were. Kay had lost her father and then had gotten close to a stepfather, and he also had passed away. And so the family really consisted there in Salisbury of just Catherine Miller, her daughter Kay, and Kay's son Jason. So going back to Elsie Underwood's childhood, he was abandoned by both of his parents. He was dumped off on an uncle who did not want him and took the opportunity to physically and emotionally abuse him. And when they didn't want to deal with him anymore, they took him to an orphanage, and he grew up in a children's home in Winston-Salem. And then the day he turned 18, of course, he had to leave. But he because of his abandonment issues that were pervasive throughout all of his adult life, he could not stand the thought of Kay being so close to her mother, first of all, and secondly, her mother being so adamant that Kay needed to be away from him.
Now, you've got this set of crimes, right? This guy obviously is a bad guy. He's a dirtbag. And he targets people he thinks are going to hurt him, bring him down, cause problems like this. So yeah. With his background, with his past, why was he not considered a viable suspect in this case from the get-go?
Well, he pretty quickly rose to the surface as a suspect. He definitely was a subject in both the Catherine Miller homicide and the Victor Gunnarsson homicide. Now, the Catherine Miller homicide took place another jurisdiction, and they had been working that homicide since early December. And then again, we didn't find Gunnarsson's body in the mountains where I lived and worked until January. So they had a good 3 weeks advance on the investigation. So once we were able to identify the body of Victor Gunnarsson, then we quickly learned that he had been reported missing in December. And he actually had been missing even before he was reported missing, because Kay was seeing him and they had made plans and so forth, and he just disappeared. Then her mother gets murdered, and actually from the time that Gunnarsson actually was missing until Catherine Miller's murder was only like 5 days. So even though they had a little almost a month ahead of us on the investigation, the actual homicides both took place within a very close period of time. So once Victor Gunnarsson is reported missing, they have a missing persons case, and K becomes the common denominator as they start to interview people and things unfold. But Kay thought initially that maybe Gunnarsson just was no longer interested in her and was kind of blowing her off, because that was just a few days before her mother was murdered. Then when her mother was murdered, her world turned upside down, and she's dealing with that, and they're having the funeral and the burial, and she's dealing with her son. And so it's just a few days after that it dawns on her she still has not heard from Victor Gunnarsson. And so when he's reported missing and investigators start talking with her more, it occurs to her in a very alarming way when it dawns on her, what if the person who killed her mother did something to Victor Gunnarsson and he did not just voluntarily leave? So she's thinking those things. They're becoming unwound, so to speak, and visible to the investigators there. Then we call and we find out we've got Victor Gunnarsson's body, and they know he did not leave at that point voluntarily. So we team up as an investigative team at that point. Don Gale was an SBA agent assigned to the Miller case with Rowan County Sheriff's Detective Terry Agner, and then Steve Wilson with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation and Boone was assigned to assist me with a homicide that we were investigating of Gunnarsson. So the four of us very quickly became a team, and Underwood rose to the top of the list as a suspect as we compiled our interviews together that we had conducted at that point, and just started the facts started revealing themselves.
However, you're seeing the pieces fall into place here. How much, right. I'm just curious, from the outside and for our listeners and myself, obviously all we know of real police work that, you know, the people that are not involved in law enforcement is off of what we know from TV. When you're doing this, did you go in with a pretty clear idea that he might have been involved in more, or did it take a while for these pieces to start to fall in place? Meaning, I guess, did you go in with a preconceived notion and then find the evidence that seemed to back that up, or did the evidence just start to reveal the picture to you slowly?
Well, at the same time that we had identified Victor Gunnarsson and found out about Catherine Miller's murder, I am still dealing with calls from the Swedish National Police, from Interpol, from anybody in Sweden or anywhere else that's even remotely tied to the investigation of the assassination of the prime minister, because even to this date, that remains officially unsolved. So I did not know if this police officer from Salisbury, North Carolina had killed Victor Gunnarsson, or if, you know, someone on behalf of the prime minister or associated with him in some way had come to the United States and found Victor Gunnarsson and murdered him because they believed that he had assassinated Prime Minister Olof Palme. So there's a lot of international intrigue all of a sudden that I'm dealing with, in addition to what's going on with this fellow law enforcement officer. And so it was real important to me, and also to Agent Wilson, that we remain objective. And just because something looks a certain way doesn't mean, you know, that's how it's going to be. So we really had to strive to remain open to all of the possibilities, because it could have been, it could have been any number of things. And but as the investigation progressed over months, then pieces just kept coming together and everything just kept pointing to Underwood. The circumstances of the case, like I said, we didn't have much physical evidence, but the circumstantial evidence was really overwhelming, and we had already caught him in so many lies, directly or indirectly. And the weapons, his weapons were missing. We conducted a search. We searched his house and his vehicles and his property, and we had multiple searches. But the weapons that were the same make and model as the ones that fired the rounds that killed both Victor Gunnarsson and Catherine Miller, all of a sudden they had disappeared, and he could not or would not. And so it was a long investigation.
You know, obviously here you have a guy who refuses to yield, does not want to own up to any of the negativity that he's done to any of this. And there's no empathy, no remorse, no sympathy for any of the situation. What's it like to erode a character like that to get somewhere in a case like this? I mean, on the outside, I'm sure it looks circumstantial, but, you know, logically, all of the pieces, again, are falling into place beautifully. You've got just too much lined up to say this is not, you know, just really weird coincidence.
Right. Well, as we continue to investigate, things continue to occur with Underwood, the center of them. A new lady that he had began to date, when we met and talked with her, and Underwood found out about it because he had told her a bunch of lies, and he had told her very little about being the subject of two homicides. And what he did tell her was made it sound like that, of course, we're the bad police and we're out to get him, and set him up, you know, this man that I had never even heard of before. And so when she began to realize that he was not being truthful with her, and things just did not seem right with him as she continued in that relationship, he actually attempted to kill her. He attempted to blow her up in an explosion in her apartment. She was a smoker and had gas. He had turned the gas appliances on in her apartment and actually had tried to kill her. So things are continuing to happen. Kay is continuing to be harassed, although more subtly at this point. And so we feel like that there are people in danger as long as he is out there. So there were times when we would go to the district attorney and we said, we realize we just have a lot of circumstantial evidence. We really believe it's enough for a jury to convict, and we're concerned about him being dangerous and people being in danger while he's not in custody, having not been arrested. But the prosecutor, he's a very wise man, and he was very well experienced, and he would just reiterate to us, we only have one shot at this. We cannot afford, you know, to lose it. Let's just make sure that we've exhausted every possible avenue of finding evidence against him. And because of his patience and our perseverance, ultimately that did come to fruition with the mitochondrial DNA, which was some head hair evidence that was found. That was the most significant. There were other pieces of physical evidence as well, but that was the most significant. But that was not until we had investigated a couple of years to even get to that point.
So I need to know then, and I know, Paula, when you're an investigator focusing on a case, you have to focus on that case. You have to take that and not start getting distracted by other angles.
Right.
But with this guy, obviously, he's done this, and he's done this before.
Right.
Do you believe that two or three murders is the end and, you know, beginning and end of his entire career as a killer? Or do you believe that there are other gravestones in his backyard?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. There was some question at some point about possibly some prostitutions, murders that were unsolved, but nothing that would clearly link him to those. I do think it's possible because of his mentality, but his mental issues were getting drastically worse over time. And I think what set him off at the point right before that he murdered Catherine Miller, that Catherine Miller was murdered and Victor Gunnarsson was kidnapped and murdered, was he had been stalking Kay ever since she had tried to end their relationship. And at one point they were even engaged. And so he was continuing to stalk her, even though she was like, you know, I just want to be friends, you know, just trying to get him away from her. And but at that point he had gotten caught stalking her. In fact, he called the scene in a restaurant when Kay was out with a male friend, and he had gone into the restaurant, made a scene, dumped tea in her lap, and just mortified her. You know, she humiliated her in the restaurant, and so he got suspended over that little stunt, and so he was on suspension from the police department when the murders occurred just a few days later. So I think the only thing that had been constant in his adult life had been his law enforcement career, and it was very problematic. And he is very fortunate, so to speak, that he did not lose it earlier, but he would go from department to department, and he would get involved perhaps in a dating relationship or a marital relationship. And when those women realized that he was not what he seemed, and they tried to end the relationships with them, he became very violent, very abusive, very assaultive, and just went to lengths to embarrass them with things like painting obscenities about them on their church, on like the outside of the church wall, their homes, their cars. I mean, just, and incidentally, that was always in red spray paint. And one of the last acts of vandalism against Kay was obscenities painted on her, the garage of her house, her garage door in red spray paint. But so the law enforcement career was, I guess, the most constant thing in his life. And so when he would get in trouble or start to get in women trouble at an agency, he would just leave and go to another one. And so when we went back to these agencies, and again, this was a different day, you know, that he was in law enforcement, it would have been, you know, in the 1970s. And there was very little documentation in his personnel files, if there even was a personnel file to be found. And so we would go back and interview those, like the retired sheriff and so forth, one county that he worked for a few years. And they very well remembered the trouble that he got into. But when asked about the lack of documentation in the files, it was more of like, well, young lady, I like to just deal with things face to face and not have all that paperwork. I just like to, you know, man to man. Like, that was an adequate reason for not documenting behavior right. problems in his personnel right. file.
Well, and I've got to guess there's some validity to that, right? Police officers, and I'm not trying to whitewash things, but police officers are under incredible strain. And they
absolutely
every day are putting their life on the line for other people and dealing with some of the worst people on the planet. That has to start to slowly erode people too,
sure.
especially if somebody's already kind of broken. You know, no matter how strong you go into a position like that, at the end of that ride, it's got to have left you hollow at points or you know, segments. I give a lot of credit to law enforcement. You know, anybody that works in those emergency fields that has to deal with death and violence and tragedy on a daily mm-hmm. basis. So sometimes sitting down, talking to somebody, getting it out, dealing with it, and not necessarily making it a part of their permanent record, giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe, just maybe, you just needed somebody to talk to. You needed to vent. You had a bad day, and I don't want to ruin an otherwise long and decent career for that.
Right.
Right. But do you think that he realized that? He played that game? He knew how to manipulate the system then?
I'm sure he did, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate what you said about law enforcement, David. And it is very trying, particularly now more than ever.
Right.
But there is a difference between, oh, I bumped up my patrol car and I tried to cover it up, or I was rude to someone that I was dealing with. I shouldn't have lost my cool. You know, they said something about my mama, but
right.
that's different.
Right.
That's very different from shoving a woman down on the floor and getting on top of her with a gun between her eyes. That is
yeah,
very different.
Yes, you are correct. But then that does seem way above a step of normalcy. Then it starts to, you can understand to a degree then why people are so upset with police work when stories like this come out, because then you realize that there's this kind of level of complicity almost in some circumstances, like it is the good old boys club.
And it was very different
yeah.
back in the day. And it is not like that now. I mean, now the amount of paperwork and documentation that's required is way over the top. I mean, it's insane. So we're talking about two different time periods, and it is not that way. And I was a police chief the last 10 years of my career, and there were many times when I could recognize a new officer in particularly, or someone who had been there for a while and who was getting burned out and had, you know, was getting careless or was making mistakes, but just needed some guidance or needed to be set on the right track. Totally different from someone that absolutely had no business in the field. And so I'm not sympathetic for, because I know the kinds of behaviors that these agency heads had seen in him. I mean, we're talking some serious violence and this blatant embarrassment and humiliation I mean, the things he put about one particular lady on the outside of her little white church, where all of her church and the community could see it. I mean, there's no excuse for that. It's not that he just,
wasn't doing
a good job.
I understand that on his aspect. I was just trying to understand, try to maybe give a little clarity to some of the listeners as to why police chiefs and people in charge may have tried to give a little leniency to somebody in a high pressure stress environment. But you're right. There's absolutely no understanding or logic to what this man did or the methodology he was taking to vent his stresses and issues. Was he also alcohol and drugs? Do you know?
He consumed alcohol some, but as far as controlled or illegal substances like cocaine, marijuana, that kind of thing, we never had any indication that he was involved in any of that. But whether he had some issues with prescription medicine, that's certainly a possibility. He was prescribed medicine for back pain, and it was interesting. His back pain seemed to come and go, because even if he wanted to go shag dancing at the dance clubs on the weekend, he seemed to be well able to do that. But if there was something else that he needed to do, work related, then he would use the back injury for an excuse. Now, I'm not saying he didn't have any back pain, but because of that, he was prescribed painkillers, so it's possible that he was under the influence of those. But I can tell you, from the time that he was in the jail, he had no substances whatsoever in the jail. And when I talked to him, it was just me and him and this evil presence. And so, that's not a justification or that wouldn't be an excuse for his personality.
Okay. And again, when you see somebody tipping the scales this far over, it's pretty disturbing. Do you know, going back, I mean, obviously you've written two books and gone in depth into this gentleman, I'm using that term very loosely, but into this man, do you start to see a pattern of irrational behavior going back farther?
Absolutely. Even from his earliest relationships. Well, during the investigation, we didn't have the benefit of talking with his childhood relations first, and then, as he progressed, we might be interviewing his aunt and uncle from when he was a little fella. And then the same day, we're interviewing a woman who had to move out of town just to get away from him. So I tried to present the facts of his background chronologically as best as I could in the book, so that people could see the progression. But as we were conducting the investigation, we might hear some horrible things that he did to a woman, for instance. And then we hear the horrible things that were done to him. And so there's all kinds of correlations, that are popping up. But his behavior and his demeanor got darker and darker as he got older, and as his life, I guess he realized his life didn't turn out the way he intended it to be, and whatever definition of success he had for himself.
It's so tragic. Yeah, it's so tragic to see somebody's life so uncontained like this, but then to realize this is something that had been a part of his life all the time. It has to make it even a little bit more frightening to realize just how sociopathic he was then, that he could continue to move from one person to another, win them over, three marriages, multiple relationships, different law enforcement agencies, and still there wasn't, and people, it's real easy on the outside to sit there and go, oh, they should have, and why didn't they? And because when you see it in bits and pieces, it's not as glaringly obvious. But when you stand back and look at the entire painting from a distance, you can see just what kind of troubled person this was all the way along. And it shows you how people like that come to power or learn to abuse power.
Absolutely. No different than Adolf Hitler. And Underwood also was very charismatic. When he would first meet a woman or even a friend, he was very charismatic. He was the perfect gentleman. It was all about, you know, he's there to protect and to serve. And he really was proud of his badge and his gun. And his house was full of self-serving, I guess, the different awards he had received, thank you letters. I mean, his entire house and everything on his walls was all about him. There were no pictures of other family members or friends. It was all about him and what he had accomplished or was taking credit for accomplishing.
And then to cold-bloodedly murder and kind of walk through it unaffectedly. That is such a strange deal. And then as you're sitting there, right? I mean, you're a detective. Your job is to get to the bottom of this. You feel this even overwhelming sense of just evil, of darkness that manifests from and within this man. There's something there. And obviously we on the outside want to ascribe something like maybe this guy was possessed. Maybe he was demonic. Maybe he was just so broken that any humanity and soul inside him had died long ago. And they say the eyes are the mirror to the soul. The reason it looked so dark was there was no soul left to shine at all in this human. And that to me really is terrifying in itself. And to know this guy could have, had you guys not pushed, had you not made those jumps, this guy could have continued this reign and done even more damage.
I think definitely you're absolutely right. Kay's son in particular, I think he was next on the list. He resented him. He was jealous over him. And at that time, he was only 15, 16 years old. He's still in high school, but Underwood resented Kay being close to anyone. He did not like her doting on her son. He did not like the teenage attitude, that all teens had. Jason was no problem child by any stretch of the imagination. You know, he was the star athlete,
right?
You know, great soccer player. But LC wanted Kay 100% under his control and for him and him alone. And he had already fired a shot into Jason's bedroom. And as in one of those things of divine intervention that I was mentioning, he would very likely have hit Jason in the head had not Jason and Kay rearranged his bedroom that very day without Underwood's knowledge, just, for the reorganization storage purposes. They had rearranged his bedroom, and otherwise there was a very good chance that where Underwood shot, he would have struck Jason in the head. And I think he ultimately planned to eliminate Jason from Kay's life.
Good God. So there would have been another body piled up on this just to have something for himself, just to be in complete and utter control. And you're right, boy, if you want to sign a divine intervention, the moving of that room, what was his excuse for having fired off a gun? Was it, oh, it dropped. I what happened?
Oh, How did he explain that? It was, anonymous, so to speak. It was during the night, and he had set it up. He had written Kay letters, and he had made anonymous phone calls, or had anonymous phone calls made to her, saying that Jason was into drugs and he owed money, and so these mysterious drug dealers were going to kill Jason because he was not paying his drug debt. But then later, we found out through the investigation that the typed letters that Kay received had been typed on a typewriter in the office of the high school where Elsie Underwood was a school resource officer and had used that typewriter. And in fact, the words on the letter were still on the typewriter ribbon when it was taken from the school.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, you forget about that. The good old days, kids. See, back when we used to have typewriters, there was an ink ribbon and it would spool from one side to another as you typed. The ink was on this ribbon and the keys would strike the paper. I'm sorry that I even have to explain this, but there are a lot of people that won't even realize what we're talking about. And it would leave behind evidence. Boy, that is ingenious. I wouldn't have even thought of that.
Yes, well, it wasn't just a result of the investigators' efforts. The secretary that Elsie asked to borrow the typewriter from, she became suspicious because he was whining and complaining to her repeatedly, "Check, don't call me, my heart is broken, blah, blah, blah." And it really just harassing her. And then instead of using the typewriter where his workstation, he asked to borrow the one in her office. And she's just getting more and more suspicious. And she's learning that Kay's house is getting vandalized, or rather she's receiving threatening messages. So she takes it upon herself to take that typewriter ribbon and let us know, and or the investigators in Salisbury, and turned it in. So just things like that, you know, that came together out of the blue was very helpful.
Yeah, I would guess so. Wow, again, just brilliant all the way around that would have even popped up. All right, so you get this guy. I mean, he's already doing time. You realize, looking back at this other murder, that there's these ties to it. How do you end up getting him? And do you end up? Are you able to convict on this other murder to the mother?
Okay, so we with the hair evidence, with the head hair evidence, and that was Victor Gunnarsson's head hair that was ultimately found in the trunk mat of Underwood's car that we got the mitochondrial DNA analysis to confirm for us. So we charge him, we arrest him, and he is convicted for that murder and kidnapping. We are all under the same assumption that next we will charge him with Catherine Miller's murder, and because that evidence was introduced in our case, and the jurors assured us that had they had that jurisdiction, they would also have convicted him of Catherine Miller's murder. So we were very confident that a jury would convict Catherine Miller. But it was the decision of Bill Kinnerly, who was the elected district attorney in Rowan County, because that's where Catherine Miller's murder occurred, in her home. So we just planned, Steve Wilson and I had planned to be, you know, expected to be witnesses in their trial, just like all of them had become witnesses in ours. And Mr. Kennerly had originally planned to go ahead with that. But then after extensive review of the case and some conversations with our prosecutors and others, including the state attorney general, he was concerned that because we had physical evidence in our case, the fact that they did not have physical evidence in their case, at least really damning physical evidence, that they might lose that case to a jury. A reasonable doubt might arise, and that might cost him to win an appeal in our case, get a new trial, and get out of prison. So he ultimately made the decision that he was not going to charge Underwood, not going to prosecute him for the murder of Catherine Miller. That is where Raging On, the second book, begins. It begins with the news that we've done all this preparation. Everybody's ready to go. We just had a win. We're ready to bring Kay some justice for her mother's murder, and she was really struggling and needing that. All of a sudden, we're done. We're not going to charge him on that unless some out of the blue, some new evidence arises that we haven't been able to uncover in the last 4 years, or he confessed, which also was not going to happen. And so there, all of a sudden, we're done. But Underwood obviously is not finished. He is raging on in prison. And now I have become his new worst enemy. as the lead investigator of the case that got him convicted. And my being a female did not help matters any either. I'm sure of that. Now he's focusing on everybody but himself. So he makes threats against Don Gale, the agent in Salisbury that he absolutely hated, against Tom Reicher, who was our prosecutor in the case, our district attorney, and against me. And in fact, the story picks up with his rage while he's in prison. He has no intentions of staying in prison, but while he's in prison, he is enlisting others to carry out his dastardly deeds, and particularly against me. And at that time, I had a toddler, I had a little girl. She was preschool age then, and was married. And he threatened to do what he had attempted to do with his girlfriend. And he wanted to cause an explosion in our house when we were home at night, when the three of us were home, and kill all of them. And he tried to enlist people to help him carry that out. And so Raging On is about his threats against us, what happened in the matters, and ultimately...
But making threats, I mean, obviously the man's behind bars. How...
Sure.
Concerned do you need to be about these threats? Does he have people on the outside willing to do his work?
Well, after 32 years of law enforcement, there's lots of people that are in prison that probably would not mourn, you know, to hear that, you know, we were deceased. But Underwood was more than there was more to him than that. There was more evil in him than the typical offender that's convicted and sentenced. So he was determined to get out, and there were times when he was caught with escape attempt plans and that kind of thing, but he continued to earn his disability retirement benefits while he was in prison, and which ultimately that's how he left his employment with Salisbury Police Department before we arrested him. He retired on this back injury. This medical police chief was more than happy to help him make that happen, to get rid of him.
Sure.
Peacefully. So he did have a pension, and those benefits that were growing with interest in his accounts, because he had no living expenses anymore. His house was ultimately sold, so he had that money. He just kept drawing checks and the interest on those checks. So he was stacking up stockpiling a lot of money while he was in prison at the taxpayer's expense. Room and board and educational opportunities or what else, you know, whatever else we paid for while he was in prison. So he did have financial means, and that's, you know, all it takes. So the way that some of those plans were intercepted was because of his communications with other inmates contracting them. One in particular who was getting out, whose sentence was almost up. He had agreed to pay $25,000, I believe, for him to carry out these threats that he had made against me and my family and against the prosecutor. So you can make things happen just because he's behind bars and he's got nothing else but time on his hand to plan these things and to communicate with these other inmates and make things happen. So it wasn't just an unrealistic threat. But the more detailed the more details we learned about it and the more detailed he became in his planning, then we began to, you know, get really concerned. And there were moments, there would be strange vehicles, you know, follow me and ride on my tail. And obviously, you know, trying to intimidate me. There was evidence of people around my house, and I lived out in the county in a rural area. You know, so there were times when I felt like I was just as afraid of Kay as Kay was, you know, afraid. But, you know, you, you learn to deal with those things, and you go on, you have a job to do and a family to take care of, and you can't let yourself get consumed with those fears. But they were more than just the typical threats that, you know, we get from someone that, you know, that's convicted of a crime.
This was worthy of concern. This was worthy of real fear because of what this guy was. And as you said, kind of what he put out. Terrifying stuff. You move forward in this knowing that he's kind of got these tendrils out there. And as you said, you can't live in a place of fear. You have to do what it takes to get to the bottom of these situations, to answer these questions and make sure that justice is meted out. Now, what is, you know, you're obviously kind of running up against some barriers. You're running up against, you know, threats. You're running up against all of this. What is your worst kind of enemy during all this? Is it just time? Is it, you know, what exactly is your biggest concern?
As far as Underwood?
And the entire case, yeah.
Well, on one level, it was that he would get before a rogue judge that would not carefully review the evidence and the trial, and that he would get his conviction overturned. Because now all of a sudden I'm his arch enemy number one, and if he gets out, his focus is going to be, you know, directed towards me. So that was an issue. We felt really good about the case. There was a one decision from a judge that was known for granting new trials to homicide offenders. And we thought that was going to happen. And he had made that decision, but then it very quickly got overturned before Underwood was ever released from prison. So there was a few moments that we were, you know, our pucker factor was up just a little bit. But ultimately we were confident in the job that we had done. And
I like that. The pucker factor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's gotta be terrifying in itself. You've got a judge who is, not always, I don't want to say the wrong thing here, but is not really a fan of justice, it seems.
He had a reputation for making just really off the wall decisions. And Underwood got hit one of his appeals in front of him. And so, yeah, there were a few days there that we were on pins and needles. But ultimately, he lost all of his appeals. But he was continuing to appeal up until right before I retired and what happened with the case. And I don't want to have a spoiler, but that is the climax and the finality of what happened with Raging On. And so I don't want to give a spoiler alert, but something did happen to change things. But also I want to mention that he developed one more relationship with a woman while he was in custody.
No.
And just because a person is locked up, you know, does not mean they're not still engaged in society. But he developed a relationship with a woman that he actually met in the jail in Watauga County when we first arrested him. And they continued to communicate and develop a relationship. And that relationship is a big part of Raging On, the sequel, because this time he met his match. He met someone who was, for lack of a better word, as messed up as he was, who had made some mistakes, who was engaged in criminal behavior, and who was as able in the realm of conning,
manipulation and conning. Yeah, wow.
That he was. And so some interesting things happened out of his relationship with her. And that's that story is also in Raging On.
Excellent. Now, before any of you write to me and, oh, what's this? She's just trying to sell a book. Yeah, that's what they're all doing when they come here, folks. We get a lot of the meat from these stories, a lot of the intricacies, and there's still some that you need to read about. And what we've talked about is still a glossary look at the totality of this very twisted case spread out over two books. We have a link for those books on today's program guide, so make sure you check that out and review it for yourself. Detective May, thank you for, first of all, serving and doing what you could to maintain law and order. And I personally appreciate that. I know Tim does. We are firm advocates for law enforcement, and we know that a few bad apples does not spoil the entire barrel. But thank you for your thank you for your tenacity and work in this field to make sure that the real bad guys get put away.
Well, I appreciate that. And I will say, just in response to the comments about the book, I never perceived myself to be an author, but this was a case that had to be told. It begged being written down and documented. It was just, there's just so many plot twists and turns and so many things happen that I just felt compelled to tell that story. I may not ever write another book about another case, but this one had to be written and had to be told. So first and foremost, I'm a cop. I'm an investigator, and that's where my allegiance is. Mm-hmm. But I just felt that I didn't have any other choice but to write this book. And I'm grateful to Wild Blue Press for them taking a chance on me and becoming interested in the story.
Well, I hope that you do continue to write, because you're talented at it. You have a great way of telling the story. And please, folks, when you pick up the books, make sure that you rate and review them on whatever site that you've purchased them from, so that way they do get seen and more people are exposed to it. We wish you a lot of luck and continued success with these books and telling the truth about these cases. So thank you very much, Detective May. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Dave, for what you do and for all of your listeners and followers.
Thank you. All right, folks. A twisted, sordid tale, to say the least. We have a link up for Raging On and the first book, First Degree Rage, the true story of the assassin and obsession and murder, so you can read the entire story. So go check it out. It's on today's program guide. You can also go to darknessradio.com, click on the shop tab. You'll see our Amazon shop there. Click. We've got true crime category. We've got our paranormal category. We've got gift category and more. So there's a lot of great things, but all the books that you hear featured on the show appear on those pages. All right, Tim, time to shake off the dust, kick open the case files, and examine this week's brand new Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Timothy, let us begin. Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. We're going to begin with a couple of interesting stories, though. Bungling police work. That's how I'll call it. Bungling. That sounds worse than just bad police work, right?
Right. It sounds like a mistake. A mistake gone terribly wrong.
Right. Scooby-Doo was involved and accidentally tripped up the trap that Fred set, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Police and firefighters in Quebec, Tim. They're the ones that are under the microscope this week. The Sherbrooke Fire Department in Canada received a call from employees of a factory near Roy and Cabana Streets on July 23rd. They reported to emergency services that a mannequin was on fire in a nearby wooded area. The smoke was visible to the factory workers, according to Radio Canada. Both police and firefighters responded to the bakery factory, and fire crews extinguished the fire. Officials on the scene saw the life-size doll or store mannequin. When they arrived, witnesses declared that someone had lit silicone mannequin on fire, Sherbrooke Police Chief Danny McConnell said at a Thursday press conference. The emergency crews discussed briefly what to do with the body, which they believed at this point was still just a charred dummy. There's your first red flag. Mm. They took the body back to the police station, where they threw it in a dumpster, believing that to be the best way to dispose of the charred dummy remains. The dumpster was behind the police station and not accessible to the public, according to McConnell. About 4 hours after the police responded to the fire, a missing persons report was filed with the station by the partner of a woman who had disappeared. The police located the woman's phone signal, which was later found in her car parked, you guessed it, near the factory, according to police. The police recognized the description of the woman in the missing persons report, and with the car being found by the fire, they decided, we better check the dumpster. The mannequin, as they called it, the police and firefighters had thrown into the department's dumpster, was discovered to be the woman's body. We were obviously sorry about the situation, and rest assured, the family is being advised about every key detail of this investigation, McConnell said. Our hearts are with her family, her partner, and the kids in this very dramatic situation. The coroner has launched an investigation into how the woman died. The Crown Investigation Agency and the Independent Bureau of Investigators are independently investigating the incident, while the Sherbrooke police are looking into the case as a suspicious death. Really? We should look into this as being suspicious, eh?
God.
Hey, sorry we threw her out, eh? Sorry. Just a little mistake. Details about the incident that occurred Friday were just made public nearly a week later, promoting the police and fire chiefs to address the public. Stephanie Simoneau, Sherbrooke's head of the fire department, wanted to clear the lack of transparency. I'm quite stunned by the news, and I can say that my entire team, the entire department, as well as those who were there that day, are in shock, Simoneau said. People were overcome by certain emotions, so we have to manage a situation in order to stabilize our teams psychologically, and that's what we've been doing. Flowers have been placed in the wooded area. Now, again, I'm not beating up on the police or firefighters in this case. You know, sometimes mistakes are made, and when they've already told you that somebody set a mannequin on fire and you go out there and there's that surreal environment of finding a dead body burning and you're thinking it's a mannequin, you know, I could see there being some mistakes made.
But shouldn't the bells and whistles all go off when somebody says, I set a mannequin on fire? I mean,
well, nobody said that they set a mannequin on fire. Somebody just called to say that from their business they could see a mannequin on fire.
Okay, but don't the bells and whistles still go off? I mean,
yeah, you would think.
You know, you would think as an officer you would mistrust that information or at least look into it further.
Well, Tim, that's not the worst bungling job. And that's hard to say. That's not the worst one that took place this past week.
Okay.
Bungling South African cops let a prisoner escape. So what did they do? Well, they abduct an innocent man off the street and arrest him as a replacement.
Wah, wah.
Two bungling police officers in South Africa have been arrested for kidnapping an innocent man off the street as a replacement for an escaped prisoner. The shocked shopper found himself handcuffed and in a police car accused of housebreaking and theft, having been switched for the actual criminal. Despite protesting his innocence, the cops in Cape Town, South Africa, threw the man into the cells at Maitland Police Station to await magistrates. His pleas that he had only been out to pick up some groceries fell on deaf ears, and he spent the night behind bars until a detective arrived in the morning. The detective realized when checking the case file and listening to the innocent man's story that the officers had switched suspects after their man escaped. Both cops were charged with kidnap, defeating the ends of justice and fraud, and the innocent man was given a lift back home by red-faced officers. Oh, at least they gave him a ride home. That was nice of them, don't you think?
No, gee.
Yeah. Magistrates heard warrant officers Ricardo Snyman and Sergeant Ciabioso Bentasso were caught out as the arrested man looking nothing like the, or they were called out because the arrested man looked nothing like the suspect. A source close to the case said the suspect had been arrested for breaking into a house and theft, but the officers realized he needed medical attention. They took him to the Somerset Hospital in Sea Point for treatment, but an officer who was left to guard the suspect managed to let him escape. So the two senior officers decided that as the police station knew they had a suspect, that they had to arrive with someone. So they arrested a random guy. They thought they would be in big trouble for letting the right man escape. Probably not in as much trouble as abducting an innocent man and passing him off as the criminal. Police spokesman Captain F.C. Van Wick said the officers, after losing their suspect, allegedly just found another man on the street they detained. They did not inform anyone of what happened. It was only the next day when the suspect was processed, the detectives realized the person did not fit the description of the person who was originally arrested. The matter was referred to the anti-corruption unit, and after an investigation, the director of public prosecutions decided to prosecute, and the pair were arrested. Finally, some justice, or is it? The two suspended officers appeared at Cape Town Magistrates Court. They have to go back to court on October 27th. How much was their fine to get out, Tim? They arrested an innocent man and put him in jail for a crime he did not commit, knowingly, because they let the real criminal escape and didn't tell anybody.
I'm going to brace myself here because I'm going to go for shockingly low in U.S. dollars. I'm going to go $1,500.
Yeah, that is shockingly low, but not as shockingly low as £100 that they were charged. What was it, like $75 American?
Yeah. Wow.
Mark South Africa off my list of places to visit. Well, that and the monkeypox virus. And did you hear about that?
Yeah, I've heard about the monkeypox virus. Can't wait to get it because then I can hang out with the monkeys.
Yeah, no, that's not how it works. It's definitely not how it works. That's a little scary, the monkeypox. But, you know, listen, all you get are rashes on your hands, your underarms, and the bottoms of your feet, and your face. And eventually the rash will fall off after it hardens into a scab and leaves you scarred. So there, you've got that going for you, Tim.
Well, that'll improve my looks.
I don't think so, buddy. You're a good-looking fella. I mostly say that because people say you and I look like we're brothers, so you're a good-looking fella.
Oh, all right.
Last week in the Supernatural News Department, Tim, we talked about acid-spitting lobsters from hell.
Yeah, I've tried to look for a few. I've got the butter already.
Well, if you can't find any acid-spitting lobsters, there's a couple of detectives that might be able to help you, Tim.
Oh, good.
Not with the acid-spitting lobsters, but just a good deal on some lobsters that may or may not have fallen off the back of somebody else's car, if you know what I mean. I hate things. Yeah. I hate things. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Oh, good grief. Let me see. This story is a doozy, and all of a sudden I'm getting 2 billion, 2 billion, Tim, pop-ups.
Oh, no.
Let's see. A veteran Florida Keys detective was charged with a misdemeanor theft after an internal investigation revealed he stole 6 spiny lobsters from a boat he pulled over last year. According to the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, the Monroe County State's Attorney Office issued a summons Thursday morning for Detective Sergeant Scott Ward to appear in court to answer the charge. I'm disappointed to have to announce this case, but the public will always hear the good news and the bad news from me first. According to Monroe County Sheriff Rick Ramsey in a statement, Ward, who could not be reached for comment, is scheduled to appear in front of Judge Sharon Hamilton at the Plantation Key Courthouse on August 18th. He has not yet been arrested. He's accused of taking lobsters from the boater during a routine resources check off the Upper Keys sometime last year. Sheriff's Office spokesman Adam Lindhart would not say when the incident happened nor comment on whether it happened during the busy 2-day spiny lobster mini season that takes place every year on the last Wednesday and Thursday of July. However, that would explain why a high-ranking detective would be conducting resource checks on the water, a job normally done by officers with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission or deputies assigned to the Sheriff's Office Marine Patrol. During mini season, however, law enforcement agencies in the Keys employ all hands-on-deck approach to monitoring the busy event to ensure compliance with conservation laws and to ensure public safety. A Sheriff's Office press release states that the incidents were reported by other deputies who were on the scene, apparently did not get their cut of the lobsters.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sore losers is what we call them in the cop game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Linhart would not comment on any other details of the case. The Miami Herald Florida Keys KeyNews.com filed a request at the sheriff's office for the incident report. The Monroe County Clerk of the Court's website shows the 22-page document is not available pending redaction. Monroe State Attorney Dennis Ward, no relation to Sergeant Ward, would only comment that his prosecutors issued the summons to appear Thursday after the sheriff's office submitted its internal affairs report. Ward was hired by the sheriff's office back in August of 2007. His annual salary, $70,000. Well, see, listen, if you're a cop out there putting your life on the line, Tim, Mm-hmm. You deserve more than 70 grand. So six spiny lobsters. Get over yourself, people.
True, but he does have Red Lobster money. See, we don't have Red Lobster money. We're looking forward to illegal spiny lobster season when some of those cops might turn around and try and sell those on the black market. Not saying that all cops do that or no just the crooked ones.
99% of cops. No. Yeah,
exactly. We're looking for the illegal fishermen and the illegal people to put them on the illegal market. You know, like the seafood trucks you might see on the side of the road where they sell them extremely cheap and they don't know where they found them from. And they might even, be turned.
Hey, they slightly. Fell off a back of a truck I was chasing down the road.
That's right.
I did not know that these might be illegals.
Exactly. Those are the best type of finds you can find at our salary. We don't have Red Lobster money.
No.
This guy has some Red Lobster money.
I don't know. Just say it. Don't be flexing your badge to steal spiny lobsters.
If you're going to help out the conservation department, just help them out. Don't take spiny lobsters for yourself.
Hey, Tim, it's been a rough couple of years for rappers.
It has been. The game has not been kind to the players. Yeah.
A lot of rappers dying. Well, Londre Sylvester, a Chicago rapper who goes by the name KTS Dre, was killed by a barrage of bullets just moments after he was released from jail on Sunday. According to police, Sylvester was shot 64 times.
Oh.
I think this is the point in the show we should start playing Overkill by Men Without Hats or Men at Work or Men at Work Without Hats, whichever the name of the band is. Yeah, Overkill, 64 times, Tim.
Yeah.
Ooh, geez. Where did this happen?
Outside
the Cook County jail.
Yeah.
You got some balls, son, to roll up on the jail and gun a man down? Sylvester had been fitted with an ankle monitor and was released after a stint behind bars related to a weapons charge. He was walking with a 6-year-old woman to a waiting vehicle when multiple suspects suddenly emerged from two other vehicles, opening fire on Sylvester. That's according to WMAQ, the MAC. Despite the number of shots fired, Sylvester was the only fatality in the apparent ambush, although the 60-year-old and another woman were injured. Apparently, the shooters were all hoping to become stormtroopers at some point. One shot of every 100 hits their mark. The second woman is an activist who assists people newly released from prison. The 60-year-old posted Sylvester's bail. The 31-year-old rapper was pronounced dead at Mount Sinai Hospital at 9 p.m. The letters KTS and Sylvester's stage name stand for Kill to Survive. There's some irony there, Tim. Which he had tattooed on his neck along with a target design. Also irony. Mm. Suspects fled in their vehicles, and the killing is still under investigation. How are cars in the parking lot of the Cook County prison jail system there, and people could just jump out and open fire, and nobody gets arrested? What?
It's real easy, Dave. They don't care about what happens outside the walls. It's what happens inside the walls.
Good God. Well, let's head to Florida, Tim.
Okay.
Tamaqua, Florida, I think. Tamaqua? I don't know. A woman was jailed and police officer injured after an incident at 3:15 p.m. Friday at a bungalow pool. Tamaqua Police Chief Michael Hobbs said officers were called for a disturbance involving three females who were refusing to leave after being asked to do so for playing loud music through one of them, their large Bluetooth speakers the kids used, Tim.
Oh, yeah.
The music, an uncensored version of the rapper Cardi B's WAP song, the chief said, has offensive language and racial slurs. When officers arrived, Hobbs said they asked the mother, Stephanie Crute, 36, of Cherry Street, along with her daughters, to leave, but they refused to do so. Hobbs and Crute pushed one of the officers, never a good plan, as his back was toward her, and when the other officers tried to handcuff her, she resisted and started punching at the officers. That's strike two, Tim.
Yeah.
And the other pool patrons. The chief said Crute's 11-year-old daughter also attacked an officer, strike three, from behind as he was attempting to place Crute in handcuffs. While handcuffed, Crute continued to kick an officer before she was put in the back of a police cruiser. Hobbs said one officer had to go to a local hospital due to an injury received in the altercation. Crute was charged with felony aggravated assault, misdemeanor, simple assault, and resisting arrest. In summary, harassment and disorderly conduct. All right, so Tim.
Yeah.
Felony aggravated assault, mm-hmm. misdemeanor, simple assault, resisting arrest, summary harassment, and disorderly conduct. Arraigned Friday, committed to the Schuylkill County Prison, she was unable to post the 10% of her bail. How much was her bail, Tim?
I'm going to go $500.
$25,000.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's no wonder she couldn't come up with that do-re-mi.
Well.
Good grief. All right, Tim, this story would have ended differently had it taken place in Minnesota in, say, my house.
Okay.
A California father caught a convicted sex offender. Where? In his child's bedroom last week.
Ooh.
Where he then tackled and restrained him with duct tape until authorities arrived, according to the police. Daniel Diaz, 39, is facing child endangerment, peeping, and prowling charges after he broke into a family's home in Stanislaus County. Authorities said a California homeowner spotted Diaz prowling outside his home around 5 a.m. on July 6. Shortly thereafter, Diaz allegedly forced himself inside the home and the bedroom of a five-year-old girl. The father of the child, who wasn't named by investigators, then pinned Diaz down outside the home until deputies arrived. The father and family members subdued the individual, and they detained him by duct taping him. Eric Layton, a public information officer for the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Office, told Oxygen.com on Tuesday. They duct taped him, his hands, and held him until law enforcement got there. Surveillance footage captured the confrontation, according to officials. No one was injured in the incident. Everybody's happy. The father, the family members were aware and able to catch him before anything did happen. Diaz is a known sex offender, according to law enforcement. In 2009, he was convicted of an assault with intent to commit rape. The incident involved a victim who was developmentally delayed, the Turlock Journal reported. He was released from prison in 2018. That's very concerning, more so for her to be a child and so young, Layton said. We don't know his intent being in that house or in her room specifically, but we do have the facts. He had a prior history of being in a residence and sexually assaulting somebody somewhere he didn't belong. It's weird that they included that. Hey, he assaulted them somewhere he didn't belong. So if he belonged there, it would be less bad. I don't understand. Your mind starts to go to those places with that kind of history. Well, I think that's a fair assessment. And Tim, I wouldn't have just duct taped his hands. I first would have put on a layer of, I don't know, barbed wire.
Yeah.
Then I'd have offered him a Minnesota waxing.
What is a Minnesota waxing?
Well, I would have taken some lard and just lathered him up.
Okay.
And then light lit his junk on fire. That would have been the end of it.
Oh, boy.
I'd have cooked it. Cooked it right then and there, because he would never, ever, ever, ever have anything down there to violate a person with again. That would be my take. Am I overreacting? Maybe. But as the father of girls, if you violate any of my children, there's going to be problems.
I understand the reaction. I really do.
Yeah. I might have tried to feed some barbed wire up the old tuchus as well.
Yeah.
Then try to pull it out the other end if you get my grip. Yeah.
I don't know that those systems are connected, but good luck trying to connect them.
Hey, I'm going to try. You know, here's the deal, Tim. You don't know till you try.
That's true. Yeah, give it the old college try and see what happens.
I don't know. Seriously, how do you just tackle a guy and sit on him and duct tape him until the cops get there? You find him in your five-year-old daughter's room. I give this father, Tim, do we have any applause for this guy?
As a matter of fact, we do. It's right here. Yep, it's right here.
We're applauding the father that tackled the guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be in jail as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Torture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's no doubt about it. Craziness. All right. We have just a couple more stories to share here, Tim. Let's see. This is a treat. We talked about this woman before, the woman who tried to hide a meth pipe in a body cavity.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
She just got caught trying to swallow car keys. She just likes things in inconvenient storage places, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Texas woman who apparently once tried to hide a meth pipe in a body cavity has been arrested for trying to swallow a set of car keys to try to prove she hadn't been driving an awkwardly parked vehicle. That's according to a report from Wichita Falls, Texas television station KFDX, the FedEx, Tim, and KGTL, the Jettle. According to the report, an officer approached Riley Sage Weiss, 23, after seeing a vehicle parked parallel or sideways near a store. Apparently, that somehow looked suspicious. The officer entered the store and approached Weiss. Weiss claimed the car was her husband's. She said he dropped her off and walked away. Weiss then activated a key fob she had been holding. The vehicle's lights flashed while the officer continued to question Weiss. Weiss is reportedly alleged to have put the keys then into her mouth. The officer then is said to have grabbed the keys out of Weiss's mouth and squeezed so she could not swallow anything. Weiss then allegedly gave the officer permission to search the vehicle inside. The officers reportedly found at least two wallets containing identification cards, debit cards, and social security cards for various different people. Weiss then reportedly admitted she drove the car but changed her story yet again to claim she was only a passenger. But she then reportedly claimed she didn't know where the driver went. She claimed, Tim, lots of claims here, she worked in a cockeyed fashion because she wanted to run into the store quickly. It's unclear from the television station's report what crime the officer suspected Weiss to have committed when he decided to approach her to ask questions, but jail records suggest she was wanted on two prior warrants, one dated on June the 24th of 2020 and one dated February 28th of 2021. The incident involving the keys and the subsequent consent search of the vehicle resulted in a new charge of the fraudulent use and or of possession of identifying information. Between 10 and 50 items. Indeed, Weiss's arrest record with the Wichita County, Texas jail is lengthy and detailed. The records indicate she's been arrested 19. The average time a person has been arrested in Texas is 19, dating back to 2015. So it's 6 years, 19 times. Why is she out?
Why?
I don't know. I'm just, what? Yeah. So when she'd been arrested last time, she was trying to hide a crack pipe in the hoo-ha. Yeah.
That's a great album name, by the way, a crack pipe in the hoo-ha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's a winner.
Hmm.
She's a winner. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Tim, I can get her number for you if you're interested.
She's taken, Dave. You've already said that in the story that she has
looking
a husband.
Love in all the wrong places. All right. One last story to share here, Tim. One last tale of strangeness. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
A drug-sniffing dog detected the veiled cocaine after authorities tracked and pulled over a vehicle suspected of ferrying drugs, Tim. The shiny blue packaging carried the image of an iced cake topped with what looked like white chocolate slivers and plump raspberries. Blanco Perfecto, it read. Perfect white. But under the wrapper, according to police, was a block of cocaine, sprinkled with coffee grounds to make it look marbled and covered up the scent. The fake cake was detected by a drug-sniffing dog Tuesday after authorities pulled over a vehicle entering Gardiner, Maine on I-295, the Maine Drug Enforcement Agency said in a news release. Following the discovery, authorities arrested John Sedano, 25, of New York City, and Chelsea Cochran, 35, of Winslow, Maine, on aggravated drug trafficking. Well, if they weren't aggravated before, they are now that their stuff's been confiscated. The deceptive dessert contained about 4 pounds of cocaine, carrying an estimated street value of $200,000.
Wow.
That's about $1,900 in cash was also seized from the vehicle by officers who tracked and pulled over the suspects after receiving an anonymous tip. Agents with the DEA believe the drugs were being ferried into Maine for redistribution in Kennebec and Somerset counties, and that the cash represented the profits from illegal drug sales, according to a news release. Sedano, also known as Papers, was a familiar name to agents. In 2015, he was charged with aggravated drug trafficking after he was found with 38 grams of heroin, a handgun, and several $1,000s. He received a 4-year prison sentence in 2016 after being convicted on that charge, according to the Maine DEA report. Sedano became the focus of a new investigation after the anonymous source led officers to suspect he had a role in spreading considerable amounts of cocaine within central Maine. The cocaine in Maine is mainly on the plane, Tim. On Tuesday, police were on the lookout for Cochran's Audi when they spotted the vehicle traveling north on the Maine Turnpike with Cochran at the wheel and Sedano alongside her. Police stopped the car on I-295 as it entered Gardiner, and the police canine indicated the presence of drugs inside the car. People confirms that the alleged traffickers are being held at the Kennebec County Jail, with bail set at $750,000 for Sedano and $50,000 for Cochran. It was not immediately clear if either of them were going to represent themselves in court or not.
The cake is fake, and if you consume it, you shall shake.
Yeah, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
An entire cake of Coke.
Yeah.
A Coke cake.
Yeah. Coke cake.
I've added Coke to cake batter, which is good. Not cocaine, but actual Coke. Have you ever done that? It lifts and gives it an airier, fluffier quality.
Yeah, the Coke chocolate cake over at Cracker Barrel is extremely wonderful.
Could you? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Could you be any more Minnesotan in the description you just told me? Yeah, that cake, chocolate cake batter over at Cracker Barrel is quite this. You were very Minnesotan there, my friend.
Well, you know, it's in me. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yep. Well, that's it for this week, kids. We hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for tuning in to the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is True Crime Tuesday.